Hi, everybody. I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic. Nice crowd. Glad you all made it tonight for our party. It's good. You know, I love I love Alcoholics Anonymous, but I love AFG. I love Al-Anon. And is there anybody new to Al-Anon in the room here tonight? Just a couple. Oh, geez, it's going to be a tough crowd. They can figure out a lie, I guess. Anyways, I just want to let you know that Al-Anon, if you're new, you are sitting in the seat of the solution right here with this crowd right here. This is a wonderful area for Al-Anon. You know, so I hope you you stay with it, you know, and keep going to meetings and get yourself an Al-Anon sponsor. It's going to be, I'll tell you the big reason why I love Al-Anon. Val would tell you this too. She probably will tell you this. Alcoholics Anonymous got me sober and gave me a life. Al-Anon saved my life. You know, so I'm very grateful that I'm here. I just said to Val a little while ago, I said, how are you doing? And she said, I'm doing pretty good. She goes, we just need to tell the truth. And I said, wait a minute. Let's not let extremes get in the way, you know. You don't ever let the truth get in the way of a good story, you know. So I was given instructions a couple of days ago to not go over time. So I bought a cheap little watch last night so I can pay attention to the time. And I've got a pretty timekeeper right over here. So I will promise you I will not go into your time. A couple of statistics about me. My sobriety date is on September the 12th, 1994. It's not the first time that I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is so far the last time that I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Well, thank you. My sponsor's name is Richard B. He was a member of good standing of the 502 Club in Covina for many, many years. And he and his wife, Carol, moved out to Hemet to retire. And that's what you do in Hemet. You either die or you retire, you know. So he went out there. I just talked to him the other day. He's alive, so I'm very grateful for that, you know. But he's my sponsor. And my home group is the Inland Empire Legacy Group. We meet on Thursday nights at Cross and Crown Church and on Etiwanda Avenue in Rancho Cucamonga. We just started that group just a little over a year ago. We're growing. It's kind of a cool group. Our focus is on the legacies, the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. And we invite a speaker to come in and talk on that one of those topics for 30 minutes. And then we open it up to question and answer from the audience. So it's kind of an interesting format in that regard, too. So. Anyways, little statistics on me. So I made some decisions in my early teenage years, specifically when I was 13 years old. One of the decisions I made was I'm going to get drunk. And I made that decision on the same evening that my older brother, a year older than me, came home, and he had been out with some of his friends enjoying the evening, and he was drunk. And he walked in and he was singing, he was laughing, he was telling jokes, he woke up my parents, it didn't seem to bother him in the least, and then he threw up all over the place, and I thought to myself, this is too much fun, I need to do this. And so I made another decision when I was 14, and that was to drink. And so I got a hold of a couple of six packs of beer on the very same beach that my older brother got drunk on. And we got together and with a bunch of kids that we hung out together in the summertime along this Russian River area. And we started drinking. We sat around a bonfire. And I got up because you rent beer. You don't really consume it. And anyways, I went over to the bushes, but I never quite made it as far as I know. I kind of did a face plant there on the beach. And then it was the next morning when we woke up, and we go ahead and turn that off anytime you want. Never mind. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that, but I did. Anyways, The next morning, I went down to the beach. I had a little tiny bit of a hangover, and I went down there, and it felt like the conquering hero had come home. All those other kids that I was with, 15, 20 of us that hung out together, they were down there, and they said, "You were so much fun last night. You got naked, and you jumped off that bridge over there, you know, and you were jumping through the fire, and you were just a blast. We had so much fun." And, you know, I was getting so much acclaim, so many pats on the back, that I thought, why would I ever give this up? This was so worth it, you know? And, you know, a few years ago, not that long ago, I was reading this book called Not God by a guy named Kirst. And he had done an extensive number of interviews with Bill Wilson in preparation to write that book. And one of the things that Bill Wilson had told him is that every alcoholic pursues three things in their life. They pursue achievement, acclaim, and romance, you know. And so I got that acclaim that day on the beach. And I'm the drive was on, you know. I was out to get that acclaim over and over and over again in my life, you know. So I started drinking in earnest when I was 14. Another decision that I made when I was 14 is to take this lady right here hostage. And we're not really certain who got taken hostage first, but we kind of like glommed onto each other. We have our own stories about why that happened. But I grabbed onto her, and she grabbed onto me. And, you know, I know that it was awfully young, you know, to fall in love, but I sure fell in lust with her. I mean, she was something special to look at. She still is something special to look at. And, And so, anyways, that was another decision that I made, you know. And the thing was, is that I started drinking when I was 14, 15 years of age. And here's one of the things that's interesting about alcoholics. We emotionally stop growing when we start drinking. So I stayed 14. I never learned how to negotiate life, how to develop strategies for proper living, you know, how to just, you know, deal with things like adversity. I didn't have that. I came from a home where alcohol ran like a river right through the home, and my parents invited us to jump in anytime we wanted, you know? And so that's how we ran in that household. So as I grew up, whenever I was confronted with conflict or difficulties or challenge or whatever, I would drink. You know, I started to realize, I didn't realize it so much as I began to use alcohol as a way for me to deal with life, you know. And and that's how it was for me as I grew up and went through my teenage years and very young early adult years. Val and I got married when we graduated from college, and we've been married 48 years so far. Yeah, you know, and hard to believe. 48 years with a little time out for bad behavior. I'll tell you a little bit about that. I'm sure Val will tell you a lot more about that. But anyways, we got married and we moved back to the East Coast and hung out back there for a year while we were trying to figure out what we're going to do, what I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And then we came back out to the West Coast and we bought ourselves a little house. Here it comes. We bought ourselves a little house, and poor Val, she was trying to figure out, well, who is this guy that I'm married to? Because he just drinks all the time. I mean, he's got a job, he seems to be responsible, he goes off and he does that, but he comes home almost every day and he's been drinking, he's drunk, he's upset, he's happy, he's, you know, whatever, in between, you know. And she started a campaign of let's fix this guy. And so among the different strategies she used was, let's build a garden. So we built a garden in the backyard, but, you know, I was soon out there watering the plants, giving them a drink of my beer, and I'd take a drink of the beer. It helped me to grow. Why not them, you know? Then let's get a dog, you know. So we got a dog. Shaughnessy was his name. And Shaughnessy and I would sit in the backyard and drink out of the same tapper, because I had a tapper in the backyard. And I stopped giving him my beer when I noticed him running in circles and running headlong into the fence. So I thought, that's not good. That's not good for a dog to drink. So I stopped that. And then, let's see, what else did she try to do? Oh, we fasted for a while. You know, we became vegetarians on another occasion. You know, there was all kinds of interesting things that we did. And then she said to me one day, she said, "You know what would make me happy?" And I said, "What would that be, Val?" And she said, "If you painted this house yellow." And I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yes, indeed. Yellow is a happy color, and I would like a nice little white fence out on the front porch and a nice yellow house." I said, "Okay, I'll do that." So I called my friend Steve, who was a painting contractor. I said, "I don't know how to paint. You do. Would you come over in here and help me?" He came over with a big 5-gallon drum of white paint, some tube of something or other that you squeeze it in there, you know, and you stir it up, and it turns yellow. And he had some rollers and a brush, and he said, "This is what you do." And he poured some paint out into a pan, rolled a little bit on, brushed it on the wood frame and the eaves, and he said, "That's how you do it." And I said, "Okay." He goes, "I'm out of here. See ya." You know, and I was like, "Well, wait a minute. I kind of invited you to paint my house, you know." But anyways, he took off and I started painting the house. But as I'm painting the house, that sun starts beating on the back of my head. And I'm thinking, this just isn't right. This is not fair. It's a hot day out here. It's sunny. This is bright yellow paint. It's reflecting into my eyes. You know, I got tears coming out of my eyes. So I think I'm going to go inside. I'm going to get a beer and calm down a little bit. Let that sun pass by. And I'll come back out here and finish painting. You know, well, a couple of weeks went by and Val said, "Are you going to go back out and finish painting that house?" And I said, "I am." And so I went out, but unfortunately, all the brushes and the rollers were like rock hard. The paint had skin on it like this. So I go down to the Ace Hardware store, say, "I need a 5-gallon drum of white paint." And the guy says, "Okay," gives me that. And I said, "I need some yellow tube that when you pour it in there, it turns yellow." He says, "Okay," gives me that. "And I need these rollers, a pan, and I need brushes." He says, "You got it." I pay for it, go home, and I get out there and I mix things up, you know, and I got nice yellow, and I start painting the wall, and that sun comes out again. I could not believe it. And it's just beating on the back of my neck, and I'm getting sunburned, and the sweat is rolling down and burning my eyes, and I go into the house to get a beer, watch a little bit of the ball game. You know, I'm going to finish it up this afternoon after the sun passes. A couple weeks go by, and it goes on like that for 8 months, something like that. Anyways, the house finally gets painted, and I tell Val, I said, "I got your house painted." She says, "That's wonderful. Let me go look." She comes outside, she looks, and she starts doing, she's pre-Al-Anon look, you know. And she's walking around and she's looking all around this house, the front, the sides, the back. And she comes up to me and she says, "Every wall of this house is a different shade of yellow." This is the alcoholic. You can only look at one wall at a time. That's the yellow house story. But the truth behind the yellow house story was this. That house was yellow. It was happy on the outside. But what was going on the inside was very dark, very grim. Because alcoholism had grabbed a hold of this family. And there were small children that were in that house, you know, and they were scared of their father. Their mom's yelling. Their father's yelling. We're throwing things at each other. It's vulgar. It's vile. It's violent on the inside. Because that's a typical alcoholic household. You know, and that yellow house was nothing more than an exterior. It was just us trying to look good to the world around us, you know, and we carried on, you know, that way until my job took us to Southern California, you know, and I thought that's going to be great. We're going to get to Southern California, new house, new neighborhood, new everything. And the unfortunate part about that story, part of the story is that I came along with that decision. And so it was the same old, you know. And finally in 1987, Val asked me to move out of the house, you know. And so she said, you scare us. You're angry. You're violent toward us. You're vulgar. And the children don't want you around. I don't want you around. Words to that effect. It may not have been quite that direct, but it was something like that. And my selfish, self-centered response was, good, I'm glad this is over with. I can now go be the guy I always wanted to be. You know, and I left that house voluntarily and quickly. You know, and I had a couple of more drunk days in front of me, you know, before I found my way into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those days was I was up in the Sacramento area attending a business conference, and one of my colleagues had scored some tickets to see the minor league baseball team up there in Sacramento. What do they call the Mud Hens or something like that? And anyways, he says to me, I'm sitting in a, I'm sitting in a like a cafe. There's a bar over here and cafe seats over here, and I'm planning, how do I transition from here to that bar and make it look normal to everybody? You know, and he comes in and he says, hey, he goes, I got tickets to the ball game tonight. There's about six of us that are going to go. I got an extra ticket. You want to go? And I said, geez, Cliff, I'd love to go, but I just don't feel very well tonight. You know, he was interrupting my plan, you know. And so he said, he goes, what's wrong with you? And I said, I don't know. I got a little upset stomach. I think I'm going to get a sandwich and a glass of milk. That sounded good. And then I'm going to go upstairs and go to bed early. And he says to me, he goes, you know what, Steve? He goes, you're not going to do that. The minute I leave here, you're going to go over to that bar and you're going to get drunk just like you do every time we come to these business conferences. You're always the drunkest guy here. You know, and I thought, well, what a horse's patoot you are, you know. And I sent him off, you know, to the ball game with a few words of encouragement. And then I went over to the bar and started drinking, and I was awakened by Cliff and his friends that came in to jostle me and say, see, I told you you were going to be passed out at the bar. And it was so, I was so full of shame and embarrassment when that happened. You know, you would think a normal guy would look at that and say, why don't you stop this crap? Stop drinking, for God's sakes, you know, but I can't stop drinking. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics have these crazy, illogical twists in their thinking that tell them, go have a drink no matter what. Are you happy? Have a drink. Are you sad? Have a drink. Are you conflicted? Have a drink. No matter what, have a drink. And then once I start drinking, I can't stop drinking. And usually in my case, I don't stop drinking until I've created mayhem and chaos all around me. You know, then I try to stop drinking because I don't like that. You know, I'm not blind to the difficulties I'm creating for people. I'm not blind to the idea that I come home and I see this lady sitting at the kitchen table in the morning and she's got tears in her eyes, you know, wondering, where are we going? What's happening to us? I'm not blind to any of that stuff. It's like that letter that Betty Ann read. We know that stuff is going on. We can't stop drinking. And I try to stop and I can't stop. I try 10 days, 30 days, never more than 30 days. You know, I'd go to a doctor, help me. No, I can't help you. I mean, there was just no solution in there. And finally, you know, after I've been kicked out of the house, I get together with Val and I said to her, do you think this, and I tap a glass of wine, do you think this has something to do with our difficulties? And she says, Steve, you're an alcoholic. You're the last guy to know that. And I wasn't the last guy, but I needed to hear it. I guess that's what it was with me. And I didn't know what to do about that. I was so full of fear all the time. I had two feelings, fear and anger. That was it. And I didn't know how to live. I just simply do not know how to live, you know. But my old grandfather knew what to do when he got, you know, kicked out of the house, I guess. He ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I had that little bit of information up here. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I asked them about going to a meeting, and they ended up directing me to a meeting, and I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous on September the 11th of 1987. Not my sobriety date that I announced earlier, but that was it. And I walked in here, and I started to try to do this deal. But what I did, and this is an important thing for me to tell you, what I did is I decided somewhere along the line that the fellowship that we enjoy with each other, like such an evening as tonight, we're helping each other to do things, paint houses. Nobody ever asked me to help paint a house, but move, you know, give me a ride, things like that. I decided that all of the fellowship opportunities in front of us was the way to stay sober. you know. And that's what I did. I did that for about 7 years. And then probably about year five of that 7 year run, the thought occurred to me, I really don't know how to go to alcohol or need to go to AA. Why do I need to do that? I'm doing okay. You know, we're doing okay. I had been invited to move back in. I forgot to say that. And we were doing okay, or so I thought, you know. But you know what? When you've got the mind and the skill set of living of a 14-year-old and you're 48, you know, and you're not drinking anymore, you're not an adult. I had never taken any accountability or responsibility for my behavior, never. It was always your fault, you know. And so dry is what I was, dry, you know, around the seventh year of being dry and never working really steps. I had a sponsor who said, are you working steps? I said, sure I am. Of course I am. You know, and he was like, oh, okay. But about the seventh year, Val says to me, you need to move out. You know, you scare us. You're violent. You're vulgar. You know, the kids don't like you. Of course, my oldest was 17 at that time. And she told me, she said, I'm going to be 18 in another, whatever, couple of months. And when I turn 18, you'll never see me again. Not the message a dad wants to hear his daughter say. But it, once again, selfish self-centeredness kicked in. And I said, who'd want to see you? Get out, you know. And I did get out, you know. But now I'm very, very confused because I'm not drinking. I'm not drinking and I don't understand what is wrong with me, you know. I come to the conclusion a while later, a couple of days later, that, you know what, Alcoholics Anonymous had worked 7 years ago. Maybe I need to do that again. So I decided I'm going to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go back to the first meeting that I ever, or the second meeting I ever attended, the Tuesday night Upland Speakers meeting. And I'm walking up the stoop of that meeting, and there's this wonderful lady that's there that's a very good friend of mine today. And she sees me, and this is what I heard. She said, oh my God, are you still sober? Gee, hey, everybody, look at this guy. He thinks he's coming to an AA meeting. And I'm walking in there. This is my seventh AA birthday, I might add. It's September the 11th of 1994, my seventh AA birthday. And I'm walking in there, and that's what I heard her say. But what she really said was, hey, Steve, how are you doing? A lot of self-condemnation in this guy. And I walked in there. My plan was, is I was going to take a 7-year birthday cake and I was going to tell everybody how wonderful my life was, even though I had been kicked out of my house, I'd been fired from a 20-year career, and I was completely clueless about what was going on with me. And I was going to take a cake and tell everybody how wonderful my life was, all because of AA, you know. And I couldn't do it. I ran out of that house. And what I did is I went out on a bottle of Vicodin. That's what I did. So I didn't go out. I wasn't going to stoop so low as to drink. But I went out on a pharmaceuticals that did not belong to me. And I stole them from my daughter, who needed them. But not I needed them more, I guess. Anyways, I went out on Vicodin. And the next day, I called a man who had been calling me on a regular basis for probably 4 or 5 months at that point. And his name was Tommy C. And he said, come on over here, bring your big book. I showed up. And we sat down in his living room, and he asked me, he says, have you ever read this? And I said, well, I've looked at it a little bit, you know. And he says, okay, well, let's go ahead and start reading it. We started right from the very beginning, right at the prefaces there, and we started reading that thing, you know, and we started working those steps. And I did a fourth and a fifth step with him that day. He pushed me through those steps quickly because what he saw was a man who was dying of alcoholism. He knew what was going on. You know, Val and his wife went to Al-Anon together. They knew what was going on, you know, and he was determined I wasn't going to die of alcoholism. Thank you, Lisa. That I was not going to die of alcoholism, you know. And so we started working those steps together. And he sent me home. He said, go home and take a shower. You smell a little bit. And you can come back here and pick me up. And we drove into L.A. We went to the PG meeting, Pacific Group meeting that night. His sponsor was Clancy. And so I won't tell you that. He was very kind to me. Clancy was. He was He was a wonderful man, and had a good visit with him that evening. But I started to do this deal differently, is what it was. And I had a man now that was really a sponsor, who really cared about me. And not that the other guy didn't care about me. He cared about me very much. But this guy, Tommy, knew what to do with me. He knew how to handle me. You know, I was like a slithering snake on a linoleum box, for God's sakes. I was all over the place, and he knew how to handle me, you know. And I can remember one time, you know, Val and I eventually did get back together, obviously, you know. And I can remember one time I called him up, and I said, I got to talk to you about what's going on at home, because she's driving me nuts. Now, you would think a guy would not say that about somebody who kicked him out twice, but I did. And I went over there and I told him what was going on, and he said, okay. He goes, well, in this case, you're right. You're right. You were absolutely right. I go, well, that's a miracle. I'm right. And I said, what do I do? And he says, you go and you buy her some flowers. You go home and say, I'm sorry. I was wrong. I won't do it again. It has worked. It works all the time, you know. I called up another time. I was complaining about her again, and he had it, he was that done, you know. And he said to me, okay, listen, he goes, you don't want a sponsor, what you want is a mommy. Click. And I was now at that crossroads that I, you know, jumping off point, as we call it in the book, where I needed to call him back and say, I need your help, seriously need your help, or I was just going to continue on with these. And I called him back, fortunately. God gave me the strength, the courage, the wherewithal to do that. I called him back, and he helped me. He helped me tremendously, you know. He moved away to Reading a number of years ago, 16 years ago. He passed away a couple years ago. Great guy. A lot of time to save this guy's life, put our family back together again, put us on a road of living a good life, you know. And I'm so grateful for that, you know. I have that legacy handed to me by him, and I get to try to behave that way with the guys that I sponsor. And the best days of my week are a couple of days. I get a couple of guys I sponsor, they come over, and we read literature together. Right now, we're working our way through Drop the Rock, you know, and we're reading that together and talking about living a better life, living emotionally sober lives, you know. I get to do stuff like that, you know, and I still attend a lot of meetings. I probably go to 7 or 8 meetings, a combination of Live and Zoom, every week, you know, and yeah, because I need to. I need to hear the message of recovery from other people. Occasionally I get to ask to do stuff like this, and I don't like doing it. I was about to say I love it. I don't love this. I hate this, you know. But I love getting to sit down like 30 seconds, you know. But lately I've turned into a service geek, for crying out loud. Everybody in AA lit their hair on fire and stuck a fork in their eye when they changed the preamble. You know, and they changed, you know, a group of men and women to a group of people. And I was like, oh, my God, blasphemy. You know, and I decided, you know what? If you don't know stuff like that's coming because you decided to go stick your head in the sand and not pay attention to the society that gave you recovery, you got nobody to blame but yourself. Accept that responsibility. And so I became a service geek. I started doing GSR work and attending area assemblies and, you know, just trying to do stuff like that, you know. And I enjoy it. It's sad to say, but I enjoy that stuff, you know. We started a new group, this Inland Empire Legacy group, out of the pandemic. That changed me big time, that pandemic. Boy, that threw me for a loop, you know. And it set me off in a whole different orbit. I started going to completely different meetings that were live, because I needed that live contact. So I ended up down in Chino and over at the Triangle Club, and, you know, some new people came into my life that are constant in my life today. And, you know, I'll tell you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't really have time to talk about everything that's happened so good for me, but our family is connected. We're together. Val and I are married happily. Our children children need to go to Al-Anon. They seriously do. But they're happy. I've got 7 grandchildren that have never seen me drunk. They've seen me act a little weird from time to time, but that's okay, because the whole family's weird, you know. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It really has saved my life, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to have shared with you. Thank you very much.